Welcome to Zero to Start, a podcast about immersive development that brings you inspiring conversations with immersive creators, developers, and industry leaders. I'm your host, Ceciliana Trevino. Will the Apple Vision Pro be as paradigm-shifting as the first iPhone? If Apple's hedging its bet on spatial computing, did Oculus slash Meta do the hard excavation work to prove there's an innovative market for XR? Does an early adopter really need another headset in their vast collection of goggles, glasses, and gadgets? These are just some of the questions Ash Bacchus-Clark, director, keynote speaker, and creative strategy consultant at ABC Worldwide, asks as she contemplates whether or not to spend over $3,500 to get Apple's first spatial computer. Ash is a molecular and cellular biologist, brand marketing professional, and multidisciplinary artist who uses new media and storytelling to explore themes of deep learning, cognition, memory, trauma, and the systems of belief within frameworks of intersectionality. She was the director of research and marketing at Hyphen Labs, an international team of engineers, scientists, architects, and artists who created neurospeculative Afrofeminism, an award-winning virtual reality project that was screened at Sundance, the American Film Institute, and Tribeca Film Festival, among many others. We recorded this conversation last week, and I'm just about to head out to the Apple Store later today to pick up my Vision Pro, and we'll have more on that later. Let's get started. Welcome to Zero to Start, Ash. It's really a great pleasure to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
So let's dive right into what was your first aha moment with virtual reality.
I remember reading an article about Palmer Luckey. I believe it was in Wired. So I read this article and I'm really interested in neuroscience. And what struck me was the way that this article positioned him as this sort of enfant terrible boy genius who would revolutionize the future of computing through this device. And, you know, virtual reality has been around for a long time, but this was the first time I had seen connection with bringing this technology to the masses of consumerism and put my science brain on. And I was like, if we're going into a future where we have a device on our face that will help us alter our reality, what does that mean for the way that our brains are developing? And at this time, I was working for Warby Parker. I was at a moment where I was ready to get back into science and do something else. So I wanted to apply to the Mind and Brain Institute at Humboldt University in Berlin. And I wrote a proposal for using VR to look at essentially over-policed communities navigate their city. And I wanted to use VR to look at the ways in which that changes your mental framing as you go to places that you normally frequent. And so I wrote this whole proposal talking about VR and like Palmer Luckey and all, you know, all this stuff. Didn't get in, but it's still stuck with me. And so 2 years later, I was still working for Warby Parker and I moved to New York to be on the brand marketing team, but I couldn't get the idea of VR out of my head. And a friend of mine, Carmen, moved to New York to go to the School for Poetic Computation. There was a module that they were working on about virtual worlds and VR and building stuff in this. And she knew that I was fascinated by it and had written this proposal because she read over it to edit it. And we were like, let's just make it ourselves, you know, but had this conversation about if we're creating content for this technology, do we want to create a piece that has the potential to re-traumatize a viewer? Or do we want to make something that's hopeful, that projects a future that we want to see in the space? And that's what we ended up doing. And so that is how neurospeculative Afrofeminism was born. And instead of using it to look at Black men and the way that aggressive policing has traumatized that community and that population, it's as a Black woman myself and having predominantly Black women in my family, my friend groups, we decided to tweak the piece and make it about Black women in Afro speculative futures, Black scientific and artistic futures, and created this piece that ultimately went to the New Frontier portion of Sundance, the Sundance Film Festival in 2017. And it was kind of a whirlwind after that, because at the time, 2017, you know, it was kind of one of a blip in VR, right? This technology was being played with and developed and evolved in real time. Content creators, I think, were supported a little bit more back then. But once we reached another sort of hitch in that pipeline of like, okay, where is this technology going?
It went by so quickly.
It did.
Right? Like, you're 2018, and then it was 2019, then the pandemic.
Yeah.
And then where there was this whole shift in understanding how we could work from home, the future of work, and what that looked like, and where we fit into that.
And now that you say that, I think instead of having this head-mounted display, right, of the PC VR, where you got to plug it in, you're sitting there, and you have to have a sensor and all this stuff, what the pandemic, I think, proved to a lot of companies is that the way that they were positioning VR headsets needed to be different and look more at spatial computing, which I think, you know, as we talk about the Apple Vision Pro, this is not going to just be a device that you have in your living room and you pop on your head when you want to escape from your reality into a virtual world or a quote unquote metaverse or, you know, these multiple realities. It is going to potentially replace your laptop or your computer, and at some point in the future, your phone, right? You're going to have a VR/AR device on your face that, if it looks good enough, if once the sensors reach the point, the cameras, the technology reaches the point where they can be as small as glasses on your face, you won't ever take them off. So you'll have a layered reality with you at all times.
Which is a highly curated one, right?
Where
you can expand and scale your visual experience, and even blocking others that, you know.
Yeah, if you don't want to see somebody, you just erase them out of your visual frame.
Right. You talk like, about the ultimate cancel culture.
Like, yeah, I don't want to look at this person. I'm going to delete them from my... And then what happens when they're actually standing in front of you, and but you've deleted them from your screen, but you bump into an actual human in front of you? Like, what kind of situation are we going to be in the future?
What is neurospeculative Afrofeminism?
Well, we can call it NSAF from here on out, because it is a mouthful. So it's a three-part project that looks at security, protection, and visibility of Black women in the virtual sense, but also in real time, because the project, we made a roster of speculative objects that are talking about computing and talking about surveillance culture. And at the time, there was a more of an awareness and a conversation around the experiences of Black and brown people in the corporate space and the types of things that you have to navigate when you get into a space that was not built for you. And more fundamentally, what happens when you get into a virtual or a digital space that was not meant for you? So you go into these gaming forums, you go on some places of Reddit or the dark web, or some of the things that you have to sit through just because you, like, I love video games and I love gaming culture, but I don't want to sit here and hear what these people have to say about me because they can hide behind their avatars. And the people who are building 3D models of, like, if I want to have my avatar be an accurate representation of me in the physical sense, what are my options when I go into these 3D libraries for someone who looks like me? Because typically, the people who are building these and putting them and selling them online, they really are creating stereotypical representations of women, especially Black women. And we also, for this project, NSAF created our own avatar. So we, from the concept of the idea of what we wanted these avatars to look like, to actually building the 3D models in Maya and Blender and all that, you know, we worked with 3D modelers, we worked with illustrators to be intentional about what the avatars that we were putting in this project looked like, what they sounded like, what the motion capture, did it accurately capture our motions and not these like stereotypical, like twerking on a pole, that kind of thing. And I'm like, you know, you see things in music videos, you see the way that we are portrayed in media, and you think that that's an accurate representation of a culture, and it's not.
Speaking of a representation, it leads right to Apple Vision Pro's adoption of personas versus avatars. They have Memojis, but with their eyesight feature, which is the people call the creepy eye, creepy eyes, right? Where you can see machine learning scanned image of the user's eyes.
Yeah.
And then on a video call or FaceTime, there's no avatar that you have to select. It's your persona. Like, it's a machine learning representation, real time generated computer image of yourself. It feels like there's a increased sense of accountability because there isn't an avatar to hide behind.
It's interesting that you say that, the creepy eye, because when I first saw the images that Apple released, you know, for pre-order and teasing the thing, I thought it was a pass-through where it's your actual eyes. But then I learned that it was a front-facing OLED. And also when you're watching movies or playing games or something, you don't see that. So I think the idea is, if you're going to have this goggle-looking thing on your face and you're talking to someone, they're going to want to see your eyes, right? That goes into thinking about personas. You know, when you're talking to someone, like, let's say on Instagram or anywhere where you have to have a profile picture or something that represents who you are online, right now, you can be whoever you want to be, right? And that oftentimes can be liberating, or it can give you the license to say whatever you would want to say. You would say something that you would never say in real life to someone because you can hide behind an avatar or quote unquote persona, an alternate version of you online. Like, I have many different alternate versions of me. Like, I'm a different person on LinkedIn than I am on my several Instagram accounts and my X, which I don't use Twitter/X much anymore.
I just have mine to, like, make sure I still have my handle. But
yeah, same. Or sometimes I'll check to see, you know, I like how people talk about some of my favorite films, but I don't go on there to get news or things like that anymore.
Scroll like we used to.
Yeah, exactly. And then I just realized that there's a generative AI integration on X now called Grok.
Grok. What is it called? Grok?
Grok.
So you're taking a look at it now?
Oh, you have to subscribe in order to use it. Interesting. Okay. Not doing that. Yeah. Like, premium plus subscriber. No, thank you.
You know, I was looking at some of your comments on LinkedIn and your questions around the Apple Vision Pro. And do you think that the Apple Vision Pro will shift the paradigm as much as the first iPhone?
You know, I have to do several things because the immersive tech space doesn't pay as much as you would think unless you're a big developer or, you know, have a really big network. So I have to do other things to supplement the work that I love doing and talking about. And one of those things is I was selling things on eBay. So when I was in high school, I love sneakers. That's one of my passions. But I would buy sneakers and sell them on eBay. That's something that I continue to do just as a part of the regenerative cycle fashion of, like, do I actually need this many pairs of shoes? And when I get tired of something, I'll just sell it. And when I was in college, the first iPhone came out, I believe it was 2007. And I wanted one so bad, but, you know, like, I was a broke college student. I couldn't afford to buy the first iPhone, but someone in my lab got one and he brought it in and he let us all play with it. And I was just thinking, like, as I had this device in my hand, which was a really beautiful object, like, I wanted it for its objectness as much as wanting it for what it did technically. But I was thinking, like, this is going to shift our entire world because now you have a tiny computer in your hand that can do everything, you know, and it created an ecosystem for people to build apps. And to now that there's the video feature and the camera feature, you have a world at your fingertips. And I really wish I had bought, like, you know, when I would buy sneakers in high school, I would buy a pair for myself and then a pair to sell. And that would pay for my pair. So I was like, I really wish I'd had the funds to buy one for myself and one to keep in the box so that today in 20, 24, I could open it up and just see what it looked like in perfect form, like almost like a museum object. I feel like Apple ushers in a new zeitgeist, right? Because let's be real, Oculus / Meta did the heavy lifting for seeing, like, is this thing heavy? Is it going to break your neck? Is the moment of inertia, you know, when you're whipping your head around, are you going to get whiplash? Like, they worked out the physics of the thing in parallel with really smart developers and engineers and stuff like that. And then Apple comes and they're like, we've shown you time and time again that we have the foresight and the prescience to see what future we're heading into. And we're going to give you the slickest looking, most beautiful thing to propel you into that future. I'm one of those people where the packaging is great. Sometimes I don't care about what's inside of it.
In a previous Reflections episode, I talk about how the AVP can erase the friction and failures of the past. And I'm being a little bit overdramatic with the failure part because I don't think that Meta has necessarily failed. They are testing.
I agree. Yeah.
But it's a web company acquiring a technology hardware company so that they can increase their value and growth through new product categories, but it's going to take them 10 years to catch up just to learn how to be in the hardware business.
Right. And Apple already has that pipeline.
What Apple understands too is that people don't necessarily want to be told what their reality should be.
Exactly. And that's why Apple's so good. Like, look at Apple, one word. That's why I'm really annoyed at when we created Neurospeculative, which is by design, like it was meant to funnel out people that this project isn't really for you if you can't look past the title. But when you have one word, that's all people want to have, because that's the way our vision works. You scan something and your visual receptors land on a word and you remember that word. If you have too many things that your eye is trying to focus on, you're not going to remember. When you're following the bell curve, Apple knows how to appeal to the masses in a way that I think a lot of other companies can't figure out. But also Apple appeals to the early adopters, the mavens. And then they also appeal to the people who are lagging behind. You know, they got the entire bell curve.
It was interesting too, like when I first started developing for VR back in 2015, you're like, what do you mean I have to buy a PC? To me, the PC was like, whoa, like that's way less.
Yeah, same. Well, my relationship with PC is like, oh my God, I'm going to get a virus. Cause that's, I had my dad's daughter, oldest daughter used to work for Apple when I was a kid. So I had an Apple when I was 3. She bought it for my dad and he's like, I don't want a computer. So it went into my office, my little playroom.
You had an office at 3 years old?
Yes. Well, I grew up in a dental office. So there were three offices. My dad had one office, you know, and I had the little office right there, and the other office was kind of, you know, where everyone else went.
What features of the Vision Pro are you most excited to explore?
I'm really into learning keyboard right now. So I was watching this video of like, what's going to be the killer app on the AVP? And this YouTuber went down the list of apps that already kind of are in the pipeline that he's excited about. And there was one that was a Lego builder app. So that, yes, like I build Legos to decompress. Like I've always loved Legos and like, especially their architectural sets. So now you can use this app and download manuals for sets that you already have. And then with the AVP, you can, you know, select the virtual representation of the block and turn it all around and build it in headset, I believe. And then you can build the actual thing, or, you know, the Lego app will show you which piece you need. It's just, it's really interesting. And then there's also apps for music. So I play keyboard, but they're, you know, it's one of those things where I don't necessarily have time to practice sitting at my keyboard. So if I go out, you can upload a piece and see the piano in front of you. And because of the hand tracking, you'll be able to practice those motions on like a virtual keyboard in front of you. And also this app, this AVP is all metal and glass. Like, I'm curious to see what your neck fatigue is going to be like if you wear this thing for more than 30 minutes to an hour.
Yeah, I think that's the other component, is that it offers the possibility of increasing productivity, but it really is going to depend mm-hmm. on how long people can withstand being in the mm-hmm. headset. And some people are more comfortable with it than others. I generally am not as comfortable in a headset after 30 to 40 minutes.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I know someone who actually, I did a job with him recently. He's in a headset for more than 10 hours a day. And I, when we met, I was like, how, like, what is your psychology, first of all? Like, I, can we had, and we sat next to each other because I was like, but then what happens when you know, I'm just like fascinated by that. And he's so brilliant, but he also, you know, he has his workflow customized in the Quest Pro that it's like second nature to him. He doesn't even think about it anymore. And like, I'm guessing his neck muscles are conditioned to have this thing be comfortable.
It'll be interesting to see if the ergonomics really, you know, like, because you could have a repetitive stress.
Yeah. Right? Oh my God. Imagine.
Like, instead of having it on your wrist because of the mouth yeah. On your wrist yeah. because of the mouse.
You're going to have carpal neck instead of carpal tunnel.
Getting back to the early risks that Meta took, do you think that this is a scenario where a rising tide lifts all boats? Is it better for consumers because now they have a choice of which platform they're on?
Oh, this is an interesting question. I mean, we can look towards cell phones, I think, to answer part of the question, in that you're always going to have people that are like, I hate Apple, right? Like, it doesn't even matter if it's the best thing you've ever experienced. It's like brand loyalty. It's like, you know, your football team or your soccer team, or there are certain people who all day, every day, they're going to want an Android operating system versus an iOS operating system. And I think people who use the Quest and are comfortable with Meta and their products in the way that they're trying to be more inclusive to developers and designers, and, you know, they have their launch pad where they're supporting this pipeline of content creators. Because really, who, if you don't treat your content creators right, who's, you're just going to have a head mounted display with no content. And so Apple's going to have to figure out a way to be kinder to the developers, because people are always going to develop for Apple because they know that they're going to get paid. Your stuff is in front of a lot of eyes, right? However, is that content going to be good, or is it just going to be a lot of it? A lot of mediocrity. The way that you do that is, like, for example, like, Apple, why didn't you send this thing to developers when you finished it so that you could create? And they probably did. You know, you have to be a certain level of, I think, creator. You already had to be in their ecosystem. But not every, you know, there are other ways to engage with community rather than being like that institution up on the hill, and the hill being the Silicon Valley. You know, you're like, you're in your Apple campus, and it's impenetrable unless you have a way in. And I think that as we're in Aquarius season, and as we see, like, Apple can't sell, and I might be getting the mechanics of this wrong, but I believe Apple can't sell the iWatch in the United States, right? Didn't they just lose that big court case with some of the biometric sensors in Apple,
yes.
the Apple Watch?
Yes.
Yeah, so the chickens are coming home to roost. Like, you can't, you have to... The society is demanding and will start demanding ethics from these tech companies because we're more informed about the potential for harm that a lot of these technologies have put into action. And they might not, we're all right now trying to turn the ship around and play catch up. I don't know if it was ill intention. But computing and technology and the increase in processing power is detrimental to our planet fundamentally, but it's also detrimental to a lot of cultures who are bearing the brunt of the raw materials that are needed to create these technologies. And, you know, Apple in particular has been insulated from it because their product is so pretty and good, and the narratives are there, and the marketing is great. Steve Jobs was an evangelist, iconic figure when he was alive. The reason why I didn't do the pre-order for the AVP is I literally, like, 2 weeks before I had to buy a new laptop. And I was like, yo, I just spent all this money on a MacBook. And then to turn around and, like, finance a
whole nother.
Yeah, I'm just, like, financially, like, right now, I'm in my finances era. I'm not just, like, 2 years, 3 years ago, I probably would have been like, give me the credit card. You know? The economy is, you know, slowly starting to level out. But still, I don't know what's going to happen after this election in the US, and I don't want to be on the hook for something that I can't pay off right away.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make, or, and then me wanting to buy two, I'm like, oh my God, now I'm gonna be like $10,000 in the hole just because I want to have one on ice. No.
It's interesting too, like when the Magic Leap came out, it just seemed like it was a vanity device.
There we go. That's a vanity purchase. That's the word. There you go. You pulled it out.
So, like, you know, there was all this stream on socials of people wearing the headset, but you weren't seeing, like, what was coming out. There were no, that was it. It was like the headset was good for getting those clicks on social media, but it didn't help seed the environment for people to actually make apps for that device. And especially when, yeah, you could make an augmented reality app on your phone for a fraction of the cost. So,
and your phone is always with you, so you'd be more likely to do that on your phone versus putting this very interesting looking contraption on your head.
Right, that overheats after half an hour.
Yeah. Some of these things I love looks at. And another reason why I was like, I didn't want to get the Quest 3 is I have all of these VR, like, head mounted, these headsets that are just sitting in my house. Now they're anachronistic technology or redundant tech.
They're bricks,
you know? And I'm like, should I keep them in case I form a museum of, like, am I going to be like the Nintendo? I went to the Nintendo store in New York and they had all these headsets on display a couple of years ago. It was like the history of VR. And as a thought exercise, it's fascinating because you're like, you know, this stuff has been around for a long time. Yeah. This is not new, but to see how the headset, what they looked like and what they're going towards, like they haven't changed that much. Cause there's only so much you can do with something to fit on your cranium, right. You know, there has to be. But when you try to go outside of when you try to break form, it really disturbs people because most people just want something that looks like a hat. And you're like, but it's a hat, you know, like sometimes I don't want to wear a hat. Sometimes I want to wear funny looking glasses type things. And so, like, I'm the type of person that, and I want to give a plug to my library because I'm like, maybe they'll buy an AVP and then, you know, the community can use it.
Right.
Because they can, you know, they get grant money and stuff. Can they buy this thing? And then I'll put my name on a list and check it out. They have a library of things where you can, like, check out telescopes and laptops. And there's a makerspace that has, like, a Cricut and a embroidery machine and all of, like, every software and podcasting setup that you can think of. This is where Apple, I think, misses a lot of opportunity, is to send a representative out in these community spaces, like libraries, like community spaces, like alternative art spaces, and teach people how to use the technology and how, because when you give people the tools to create something, they'll create something that you would never even have thought of.
What do you think of Apple's bet on using the term spatial computing versus the standard acronyms that we all know, like augmented reality, VR, XR, MR? Do you think that those debates are just noise or they're truly important to outcomes?
I think that it's an important conversation and an important distinction, because like you said earlier, people don't necessarily want someone to tell them what their reality is. Number one, what is virtual? You know, these terms where you're trying to figure out what exactly it is. Spatial computing, we're all aware of what computing is, right? And we all exist in space. So when those two things are put together, I understand exactly what it is without having to think about it. That actually, because I was on the fence, I was like, you know, when I would look at the images and see it, I thought it looked cool. Like I would wear it as a fashion statement because they look like ski goggles to me. And then when I saw the eyes, I thought it was really interesting. The strap, though, looks like it might get kind of tight after a while, but I still think it looks pretty cool.
It looks like it's going to get dirty.
And dirty, exactly. I mean, most Apple things, is there's maintenance into making it look pristine, unless you put a case on it. Outside of that, when someone, I don't remember who I saw framed it like that on LinkedIn. It's another, someone else who was like commenting on that post you contacted me through. And he had posted a few weeks earlier about this OLED screen that Samsung released.
The transparent screen?
Yeah, the transparent screen. And I was more excited about that than the AVP initially, until someone framed it as spatial computing. And in that sense, and also there's a feature where if you look at your MacBook, it will pull what's on your screen up into space. I think about the concept of memory palaces, right? And memory consolidation. Once you start computing in space, we're talking about our memory. Like, I've outsourced my memory to Google a long time ago, but I think that this device is going to help bring memory and the potential to remember things and to hone your memory back into our person, back into our brains, because now you've involved your entire space and environment in the process of looking at a screen or an overlay.
It's funny because there's this whole conversation around getting rid of the screen, right? Like, but you're breaking through the screen, or it's a mirror image. You're like, it's a screen. Like, it's still a screen. If you haven't it really, it's not a hologram.
But is a virtual screen a screen, or is it a lay? Like, I'm also trying to, we could go into the philosophy of this thing too, of like breaking form, breaking screens, synaptic plasticity, and all of these things that are concepts that are out in the ether of like, how do we measure it? How do we begin to fathom it? But it's happening. And that's where quantum physics and computing comes in, because the nature of reality is like, the only thing that you can say for certain is real, and sometimes you can't even say that, is what's right in front of you, because the world behind your head doesn't exist until you look at it in your own framing, right? That POV, that perspective. Once Apple figures out, though, how to connect us with someone to dust my space as I'm in headset all day, that's going to be, you know, because the world is still going to exist. And who's going to maintain our actual physical spaces while we're all in virtuosity?
I think that's a really good point. That could be a new service, a new service category. Yeah.
While you're in VR, I'll come and clean your house for you.
I mean, that's the thing too, right? Like, in VR, you have so much more space that doesn't take up any physical space. Mm-hmm. And there's no consequence to creating a mess in your virtual world.
Maybe we'll all learn how to live within our means, is if we can expand our spatial reality in with computing instead of, you know, taking up physical space away, and we can rewild the planet.
Why do you think it's important to start creating experiences for the Apple Vision Pro, or even just on virtual reality?
I think it's important because these big companies are hedging their bet that this is, and by hedging their bet, I mean, this is where they're telling us the future of computers and technology is going. And the fact that there's AI integration in cell phones now, you know, AI integration in the new Ray-Ban, like Meta AR glasses, there's the AI natives who understand it's not going to be some like robot walking around like, you are going to die, with lasers beaming out of their eyes. Like, maybe at some point, but it's going to be AI has infiltrated every part of your life, which it already has. Like, chatbots and these sorts of things have been around for a long time, right? So there's a video from Stanford Online. They have a YouTube channel, and Andrew Ng, who's a AI researcher at Stanford University, has a video called Opportunities in AI for 2023. It came out about 4 months ago, and he talks about the distinction between generative AI and supervised learning of artificial systems. And that is where a lot of people think that the future is going towards. So supervised learning is the ways in which artificial intelligence systems will be able to communicate with other artificial intelligence systems, rather than you having to generate prompts to have, you know, an AI like ChatGPT-4 or Stable Diffusion or any of these other texts sent, telling them what you want.
And we'll be sure to have a link to that video in the show notes. Let's dive into a little bit about how you help brands create immersive strategies and what you enjoy about designing and creating for immersive tech.
Right now, I would say that I focus more on the ethics and the way that you're building inclusion into your strategy. And what I mean by that is, like, can everyone physically put your headset on? Is there an onboarding process that needs to be considered in order to help you have mass adoption of your strategy or your product? How are you communicating this to people who don't have a technical background or who might not necessarily want to know about the technical background? You know, like, I just, being a touch point between the technical and the non-technical element of your business, you know, I can do that through workshops or through lecturing, through building out your business strategy. I really like that. A lot of the work that I do is in the university. So I lecture quite a bit, both in the US and abroad. I work with art institutions and do like futurist workshops. That seems to be the bulk of what people want me to talk about now, is like, what does a speculative future look like? An object-based speculative future. What does the speculative future of our brain development look like? And also, what is the speculative future of business and startup? And what direction are we going in that regard? Entrepreneurship, you know, how do you build a futurist strategy into the way that your business is going? And how do you hedge your bet on that future and prove to the stakeholders that there is a viable ROI on betting on a projection that may or may not happen, but you think is going to happen based on evidence?
What's your advice for people who don't necessarily see themselves as a technical person or don't think that they have the skill set to get into spatial computing?
My advice is to partner with people. You know, we always think we have to do things in isolation, right? I would have been able to do a VR project had it not been for Carmen Aguilar Iwej, Ejay Tunkal, Nitsan Bartov, all of the plethora of people who helped bring this VR project to life, because it takes production, especially production. We had to complete this thing in less than 6 months.
Oh, wow.
And actually, really in a month, because we didn't get funding until maybe 7 or 8 weeks leading up to the Sundance Film Festival. So we had been accepted and we were like, oh my God, it's not. We took out personal loans to build the first part of the thing. Was up all night and all day. We'd wake up emailing people, go to sleep emailing people, trying to find partners. Like, half of what you do when you get into computing or wanting to make something is asking people for support, either in-kind donations or financial, to make this stuff happen, because it's expensive and it can get expensive. But what I'm learning now is that, like, if I want to make something, it doesn't have to be this huge production. It could be me tinkering with something on my laptop or just playing with the AR feature on my phone, which is now integrated into, like, if you have an Android, that feature is already there.
And a lot of templates are available too. There's a ton of things that you can get right out of the box and learn.
Download it for free. Also, what I think is very interesting of people who don't understand or don't have a vantage in the pipeline of creating something, most engineers build stuff with paper, pencil, sticks, stuff you can get at the dollar store before ever putting together a motherboard or, you know.
like the post-it notes.
Because how can you can't just jump into building something before you sketch out the idea. And so that, when you lower the barrier of entry for people into materials that they can understand, and you go to the 99-cent store and you go with like $10, $15 and buy some things that you think kind of look like, and look up a picture of a Arduino or a motherboard, or if that's what you want to get into. If you want to get into mechanical stuff, play with Legos or architectural engineering. You know, play with things that are affordable and you have access to that look sort of like the real thing. What you don't understand of how to build the real thing, there's a lot of forums.
I mean, YouTube, it's like there's never been a better time.
YouTube, oh my God, right? Oh my God, you can learn anything. And ask questions. You know, a lot of researchers, especially in universities, are really accessible, especially if you ask some important questions that they've already been thinking about. Some of them are more than willing to help you or like give you a lab tour and, yeah, invite you in because they need help too. They, you know, a lot of times the people that are building this things, they get stuck, but they're termed an expert. You know, I think that's the problem with a lot of things. Once you become an expert, it makes you less likely to want to ask for help or to seek help, even if you need it.
Yeah. I find in this space, it's really important to have the mind of a beginner because it's very easy. Like now 5 years, 10 years in, there's some basic things that you sort of take for granted or mm-hmm. overlook because mm-hmm. like you said, you have this sense of expertise that creates a bias almost.
Right. Yeah. And then that bias is built into the products that you make if we're being completely real, because even if you see something and you know that it's not right, because you're going to double down on the fact that you know what is best, you are less likely, I think, to ask someone who may not know what you know in terms of the technical, but they know that this is not going to work for them. And if they say that, hey, I'm sorry, this isn't going to work for me, you're going to tell them the 110 reasons why it will work for them based on the other things that you've built. But this one thing, I guarantee you, if someone has the courage to tell you this is not working for me, there's probably a lot of other people who are like, hey, this isn't working for us either, but they don't want to tell someone who's the expert. I have no problem telling the expert, hey, this isn't working for me. I want to use this technology too. And I think it's important that people who look like me, who have my lived experience, are also represented in the technology.
Did you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Well, I want to say thank you for having me. This has been a very energizing conversation. I guess what I am taking away from this conversation that I want to think about and integrate into my own practice is retaining that beginner mindset. I think once we learn something and we put it to use and we take ownership over the idea, we want to protect it, even if in that protecting we lose sight of other things that could allow us to do and be better. And I think by adopting a beginner mindset and trying to always strive for that, we'll be able to continue to evolve on technology and use it for good. Use technology for good.
Excellent. Thanks so much for joining me today on Zero to Start. It's really been an inspirational conversation and wishing you all the best and brightest for 2024.
Thank you. Likewise.
I hope this episode inspires you to go from imagining the future to building it. Be sure to check the show notes for how you can connect with Ash and for links to the items that we covered in today's episode. You can support Zero to Start by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a rating and share this episode with your community. Until next time, happy installing.